a new word was born. The word was born at a 3:30 p.m. rehearsal for a live television show airing for the first time that evening. The word would go on to become the Merriam-Webster Word of the Year for 2006. The word was truthiness, and the television show was The Colbert Report. The new word was not in their original script, which simply used the word truth. But during rehearsals, Colbert felt that the word lacked the ridiculous quality needed. In introducing the word truthiness on the show, Colbert realized that the word police and the word anistas over at Webster's might not agree that it's a word, but that didn't matter. Colbert's no fan of dictionaries or reference books. They're elitist, constantly telling us what is or isn't true or what did or didn't happen. And so the word truthiness was born. But what does truthiness mean? According to Webster's, there are now two official definitions. The first is that truthiness is a truth that comes from the gut, not books. The second is that truthiness is the quality of preferring concepts or facts one wishes to be true rather than concepts or facts known to be true. In the first episode, Colbert brought up the subject of the Iraq War, saying, if you think about it, maybe there are a few missing rationale for the war, but doesn't taking Saddam out feel like the right thing right here in the gut? Because that's where the truth comes from, ladies and gentlemen, the gut. In interviews that Colbert later gave out of character, it became clear that one of the main goals of the show was to make fun of what he regarded as a disdain for truth and facts in favor of emotionally driven perceptions and falsehoods. Well, this morning I want to propose to you that Stephen Colbert is a modern comedic version of Jeremiah. Because if we look at both our readings from Jeremiah today, it's clear that Jeremiah is irked by what our translation calls deceptive words. Other translations call it lies or false words. Part of being a prophet for Jeremiah was being a defender of the truth. At the very end of our reading, Jeremiah sums up the state of the time saying, truth has perished. It's been cut off from their lips. In the end, Jeremiah and Colbert not only defend the truth, but they also understand how the perishing of truth can have violent and oppressive consequences. Both would likely agree with the old adage that the first casualty of war is the truth. This morning, I'd like to explore truth and truthiness in relation to the war on Libya. I'm going to share with you some competing claims about the war, and your job is to determine for yourself what's truth and what's truthiness, or as Colbert sometimes likes to say, veritasiness. The first claim to explore is whether we're attacking Libya for humanitarian reasons. We've been told that we are doing this because, quote, for more than four decades, Gaddafi has denied his people freedom, exploited their wealth, murdered opponents at home and abroad, and terrorized innocent people around the world. Okay, keep that in mind while we consider the competing claim. The competing claim doesn't challenge that Gaddafi is evil. The competing claim is that since the post-World War II era, when Eisenhower declared that the Middle East is the most strategically important region of the world, our nation's actions have been guided by a desire to control the region because of its oil. Now there is a simple test that could help us to decide which of these claims is truth and which is truthiness. The test is whether the same officials making the claims of humanitarian intervention are seeking to act on behalf of victimized citizens in the countries that willingly serve our desire to have power and control in the region. For example, are we seeking to end the violence of Saudi Arabia when they attack protesters in their own country or when they invade the country of Bahrain? And what about Bahrain's killing of its own citizens? Notably, we have a good relationship with the Bahrain monarchy as they let us station in their waters the U.S. Fifth Fleet, the most powerful military force in the region. Or what about Yemen, where protesters have also been killed? Why aren't we taking action there? One could also perform a similar test by looking at Libya's own history. Until recently, Libya has been our ally. We joined forces with them to attack Al-Qaeda. And Libya had let companies from the U.S. and Europe control its oil. What changed? After all, Gaddafi has been in power for more than four decades. Something must be different. One clue might be a 2007 cable sent from the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli that was later released to WikiLeaks. It reads, "Those who dominate Libya's political and economic leadership are pursuing increasingly nationalistic policies in the energy sector that could jeopardize efficient exploitation of Libya's extensive oil and gas reserves." It's long been documented that in the private quarters of our country's planning rooms, the, quote, virus of nationalism is considered one of the greatest threats to our quest for global power and control. Meanwhile, Libya has also vast territories that have yet to be explored for oil. Essentially, Libya's regime has become undependable with respect to our desires. It wasn't doing what the West wanted, and as the world's leading financial newspaper, the Financial Times, points out, all of this is taking place at a time when rising oil prices could have definite repercussions for the U.S. economy. So what's truth and truthiness? Are we to believe that we're acting for reasons of goodwill, or are we to believe that we are acting for reasons of self-interested power and control? Let's consider another set of competing claims. On the one side, the claim is that the United States worked through the UN to institute a no-fly zone that would stop the regime's attacks from the air and protect civilians. The competing claim is that the actual record of U.S. military action demonstrates that the United States has done more than prevent attacks from the air and has actually endangered and killed civilians. In theory, a no-fly zone would mean preventing aircraft from taking off. But is that what happened when U.S. gunships fired 110 Tomahawk missiles on the first day of the attacks? At the cost of at least $1 million per missile, we destroyed entire airports and airfields, refineries and fuel supplies, or any location where Gaddafi or his henchmen were suspected to be. While outside confirmation might be difficult, past experience demonstrates that despite claims to the contrary, the U.S. military bombardments are never surgical strikes that spare civilian lives through scientific precision. Furthermore, while we're told that we will not use troops on the ground and we will not be, quote, broadening our military mission to include regime change, our recently revealed secretive actions paint a different picture. The lead stories from a few days ago tell us that over the past several weeks, the CIA has been working with rebels to get rid of Gaddafi. Moreover, there was the secret authorization of arms shipments to the rebels in violation of the UN mandate for arms embargo in the region. Finally, there's the report of the on-the-ground rescue of the U.S. pilot that involved the shooting of six civilians, including a little boy. So what's truth and truthiness? Are we to believe that we are there only to keep friendly skies for the civilians below? Or are we to believe that we're doing much more than that, and that we are, in fact, acting in ways that harm civilians? I don't want to be accused of painting too black and white of picture when it comes to truth and truthiness, so let's consider the claims pertaining to Benghazi. For the sake of argument, let's say that one concedes that the U.S. is not motivated by humanitarian reasons, and that for reasons of self-interest, the U.S. is doing more than protect civilians and instituting a no-fly zone. Let's further imagine that one nevertheless supports what the U.S. is doing on the basis of the claim that we are morally compelled to support military action because the rebels in Benghazi have asked for our help in preventing a massacre. To make this argument all the more compelling, let's push to the side the matter of whether we should also be taking action in places like the Ivory Coast, Darfur, and the Congo, for similar reasons. We don't want to muddy the water by thinking about whether we should be trying to prevent other massacres all over the world. With these presuppositions in place, the claim is simply that we should take military action in Libya because we have been invited to save innocent lives. To counter this, one might claim that the moral matter at stake here is not simply whether to take action, but how to take action. According to this line of thought, the prudent course of action for minimizing harm is a nonviolent one on our part. The scholar Vijay Prashad has proposed other means by which the United States could have sought to protect the people of Benghazi. First, we could have worked with the Arab League and the African Union to provide peacekeepers to prevent an assault. A further idea along these lines is a refugee corridor to Egypt that could have been created along a direct route that already exists. A second proposed measure is that the frozen assets of the Gaddafi regime could have been turned over to the rebels so that they could have armed and defended themselves. Now, the tricky thing with judging between claims and counterclaims when it comes to Benghazi is that the claims rest upon hypothetical predictions of what may or may not happen if certain actions are taken. This makes it less a matter of truth and truthiness and more a matter of what is or isn't effective strategy for minimizing or preventing death. Here, an honest assessment of past military actions by the U.S. in the Middle East would be a relevant guide. Now, one could further say that this is not just a matter of strategy, but it's a matter of discerning what is or isn't God's will, which brings me back to Stephen Colbert. There is a segment on his show that addresses this very issue. It's called Yahweh or No Way. For this segment, Colbert takes a current event and decides whether it is part of God's will or against God's will, whether it's Yahweh or No Way. When a creationist who owns a dinosaur theme park declared that he would not pay $470,000 in payroll taxes to the IRS because he was employed by God, Colbert declared this Yahweh. When it was claimed that Mormons posthumously baptized Obama's ancestors and turned Obama from a secret Muslim to a secret Mormon, he declared this No Way, because Mormons don't drink, and Obama, as in the case of the famous beer summit, will use even the flimsiest excuse to have a beer. Now, every once in a while, if Colbert is not sure whether something counts for Yahweh or No Way, he'll say it's a middle way or a maybe way. If we were to use Colbert's framework this morning, the question for us is whether the war in Libya falls into the territory of Yahweh, No Way, or maybe way. We're not completely at a loss for determining God's will in these matters. Jeremiah lays out for us guidelines that fall of what falls into the category of Yahweh's way. In our first reading, he says, if we truly amend our ways and our doings, if we truly act justly with one another, if we do not oppress the alien, the orphan, and the widow, if we don't succumb to idolatry, and if we don't shed innocent blood, then God's will truly dwells with us. If we were to summarize and translate today's readings into contemporary language, we might say, brothers and sisters, don't let your gut decide what's right. Use your head. Don't follow the way of truthiness to the land of no way and maybe way. Instead, follow the truth itself. Only the truth will lead you to Yahweh. Amen.